Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I am your host, Monica Hadley. And our guest today on Writers' Voices is James Charles Smith, who is a debut author who embarked on a journey from journalism to engineering before penning his first novel, Flightless Falcon, which we are going to be talking about today. James was born in Texas, traveled widely as a U.S. Air Force brat. He attended college at the United States Air Force Academy and resigned during his first year, which is the inspiration for Flightless Falcon. Smith earned his bachelor's degree in journalism from the University of Missouri in Columbia. Following journalism school, he worked for 10 years as a writer, editor, cameraman, producer, and director. Then he returned to school for an engineering degree. He must really like going to school. Once an engineer and engineering manager, his duties included writing and publishing technical reports, etc. And he currently lives in the foothills of Georgia's Blue Ridge Mountains. Welcome to Writer's Voices, James.
Thank you.
So, James, when I'm reading Flightless Falcon and I'm reading what your background is, I almost feel like this is more of a memoir than a novel. How much of you is in this character?
Well, the general trajectory of the story is pretty much a memoir as far as, yes, I went to the Air Force Academy, yes, I resigned, and yes, I hitchhiked home. Beyond that, though, it's all fictional. The characters are totally from my imagination. The events that happen during the story itself are products of my imagination only.
Okay.
It would have been a pretty... Actually, the trip was fairly boring. I had to, you know, make a lot of stuff up.
So... When you, why did you decide to go to the Air Force Academy? And why, you know, I mean, Sam Roberts, who's your protagonist in Flightless Falcon, I don't think he's really sure why he decided to go. Did you ever figure out why you made that decision to go? I mean, the novel is, as I read it, is basically his trip home was learning why he dropped out, figuring out for himself why he really dropped out. But I'm not sure if he ever really figured out why he went in the first place.
Well, the reason he went in the first place is because his father was, just like my father was a colonel in the Air Force. And he was excited about me going, Sam going. I'm kind of talking in duality here, but
yeah.
Anyway, But anyway, and so, like I felt, Sam also felt that the chances of him being accepted and nominated to the Academy were fairly slim. So why not humor his dad and go through all the tests and everything else? And as I described it in the book, it just seemed like I woke up there one day, you know, and I pretty much knew right away I didn't want to be there. So you have to be a very dedicated person to put up with all that stuff for sure.
And
so I took almost a year trying to figure out how to extricate myself fairly honorably, you know.
Now, Sam is, it's during the Vietnam War and fairly kind of right in the middle. Right, of the Vietnam
War. That's right.
So was that the case with you, or were you later than that?
Right. No, the timeline is accurate as far as what happened to me. Okay. Yes.
So I wonder if we hadn't been in a war, would that have changed anything for you or for Sam? Well, it wouldn't have made it as dramatic for Sam, obviously, because the dropping out of the Academy was partially because of him not really wanting to go to Vietnam and be involved in that war, but also because of the division in the country over the Vietnam War, it made his decision to drop out more confrontational, perhaps.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it would not have been a big deal if in another era or something, or today, if the character said he was resigning, there wouldn't have been any much controversy. But I also have to say that in addition to the Vietnam War, and that was probably a stance that he developed over that year at the Academy, slowly by learning what was going on in Vietnam. But his idea that the military had complete control of his life was something that he, and that it was very a structured life too, was something that fundamentally set him off.
Yeah. So what made you decide you wanted to write this book?
Well, it was right after I finished the trip, more or less. I had this in the back of my mind as, you know, hey, this is a pretty good, road story book. But it was something I could never really get around to writing it. It was a difficult book to write in that it wasn't, you know, it's not an action thriller, or it's not a spy movie. Book or anything like that. And it was kind of hard for me to work out how to write the book. And the other thing too, is that I didn't put a lot of thought or time into it because I was busy providing for my family and working as first in television and then as an engineer. I always remember trying to steal work time so I could have personal time and family time. So going up to my room and working on the book didn't seem like the thing to do.
You mentioned that you lived in Cedar Rapids, Iowa for a while. And of course I'm mm-hmm. here in Iowa. Were you by any chance working at Rockwell?
No, I was working at Iowa Electric. I was at the nuclear power plant in Cedar Rapids.
Okay. So, and now you're living in, what state did we say, Georgia?
Georgia, right. Yeah. So I've been in Georgia since 87, so I've been here a long time.
Oh, wow. So you said it took you a while to figure out how to write the book, and let's go dig into that a little deeper.
Okay, sure.
So, you know, in some sense, it's a very simple story. You know, this young man gets out of the, you know, decides to resign and is hitchhiking home and facing an uncertain future because if he doesn't get back into college soon, he'll be eligible for the draft. I didn't realize that originally that the draft was an open draft, because when I remember the draft, it was you had a number. And
right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. So why?
Well, that happened, and I go through that episode in my book.
I know.
Everyone is listening to the lottery and
right
and listening for their fate to fall. You know.
And I didn't know that there wasn't a lottery early on. I thought it was always that way. Why did they change it? Do you know?
That's a good question. I'm not absolutely sure. I guess I wasn't paying attention except to know that it happened, you know.
And was the lottery a one-time thing, or did they change it up every year? Did they redraw?
No, every year there was a lottery for the people
born that year. Yeah.
Well, yes. In other words, but if in 1970, for instance, they did the first lottery and set my number, that meant that I was no longer in the lottery. That was my number.
Okay. Okay. And then the next year they would draw again for the people turning 18 that year?
That's right.
Okay. Wow. So anyway, back to how you were structuring the story. So in the way it's structured, there's it's sort of flashing back a little bit from, you know, you've got this road trip, but there's flashbacks to the Air Force Academy, to high school, to you don't really go too far back in childhood. But what made you decide to do it that way instead of writing it linearly?
Well, that was one of the big things I wrestled with, and all the times I worked on this. because fundamentally it's a road story, I wanted to get Sam on the road as soon as I could. So that got me to the point of where I needed to tell that part of the story and then use flashbacks to give you the backstory and other things that had happened to his path to build his character more or less. So, and that was one of the things I really wrestled with. And I did a lot of outlines and tried to figure it out. But for a while I had, you know, flashbacks within flashbacks. So it was, so it was kind of a mess. And I have to say that I had an editor who really helped me to see a clear way to present that. So, you know, he said, you know, deal with the romance part of, I mean, the resignation first and establish that as a fact and then deal with the with his romance. And then get them on the road, you know, as quickly as possible.
Yeah. Yeah.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. It does. Now, one of the rides that Sam gets is with somebody who, when he finds out he's resigned, is very angry at him. Did you personally have that experience?
He was made up.
He was made up.
So that's what I mean. You know, I needed a dramatic moment at that point. So I had that. So he is great. Well, all of the people who pick him up are, they may be pieces of people I know or, but they're not, they are imaginary people.
Okay. So you didn't have any, personally, you didn't have any really dramatic rides.
Like I say, it was a pretty boring ride. It would not make much of a good book if I just wrote it as a memoir. I didn't even have the big storm or any of the other things that were the dramatic moments along the way.
Oh, wow.
That came from a storm I experienced in a whole different time. So
Okay. So the state, he's going Colorado into Kansas. And then clear across Kansas and then clear across Missouri because he's heading to St. Louis and with limited funds and not sure how his welcome will be when he gets home. I'm curious too, was that the case for you too, that you weren't sure how welcoming
yes,
your family would
definitely
be?
Definitely was.
Yeah.
Definitely was. I mean, I tried for a year to honorably extricate myself. Shouldn't have bothered. I should have just done it because it didn't amount to anything as far as me being able. So my father and I were pretty much avoided talking about it for the next 10 years. So it wasn't until I had my own family that he kind of warmed up to me.
Oh, so in the end, it was okay.
Yeah.
So how long did you actually spend writing?
This book? 5 years.
5 years.
And so I started in 2018 and I thought mistakenly that I might get it out as a 50-year anniversary of the events, but it didn't happen. So.
And are there, you know, who did you have as your first readers?
You know, I have friends who are also writers, and I think I put in the acknowledgement the list of people that I had read some of the early versions of it, and so I counted on them until it went away to the publisher, and then there were other editors who got involved. So,
and were any of the Did you have anyone read it who also had gone to the Air Force Academy or had that experience? That nope.
I've lost touch with all the people that I knew at the academy over the years.
Well, that's a good question too. How much are the characters at the academy, like, is mainly his roommates the main character? There's a couple others that we get to know a little bit, but mostly his roommate. Was that based on real people?
Yeah. Yes, it was, and the names were changed to protect the innocent, but yes, those people, the stuff that I wrote about the Air Force Academy, I didn't want to embellish that or exaggerate it or make it I felt a duty to keep that as true as I possibly could. So that turns out to be more factual.
Oh, that's interesting. So,
and the same thing can be said with, you know, I did a lot of research into what things were happening at that time. What did things look like? I wanted to make sure I didn't go to a restaurant that wasn't established yet, you know, that kind of stuff. So I did tons of research on that.
Oh, so like the restaurants are real? They're real places?
Yes.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. So the Air Force Academy is, I didn't realize that the hazing would be that severe. I know, you know, a normal boot camp, yeah, but it's like 6 weeks, right? Or however long that is. But this is a whole academic year.
That's correct.
And I just, it's like, is that really the only way to train officers?
You know, I don't think it's like that anymore.
Okay.
I mean, well, for one thing, they had to have changed certain things they did just when they started allowing women to go. They had to change the practice. You know, you couldn't have shower formations where everybody was in their underwear in the hall doing push-ups and other torturous things, you know.
Yeah.
So they had to have changed that somewhat. And I do believe that the Air Force Academy has modernized. I don't know anybody I could talk to about it and whether that's true. But I think that is the case, just like the rest of the military.
Right, right. You know, Sam was sort of torn about whether or not, I mean, he didn't like that. He didn't want it for himself, but he kind of understood the reasoning behind that behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
That because you have to, when you're in a battle situation, you have to have people who aren't going to question or just going to do what they're told, no questions asked. And it's kind of sad, isn't it, that's necessary.
It is, though. I mean, it truly is. You cannot have, I mean, a volunteer army only goes so far. You can't have them volunteering for everything. They've got to have a,
So I
guess Sam, and I feel the same way, Sam did not blame the military or think of it as an evil thing. He just saw it as something that was totally unsuited for him.
Right, right, right. So, James, why don't you read a little bit from Flightless Falcon?
There you go. This is basically a description of his second ride once he gets on the road. Not a second ride. It's basically he gets a ride with two Hispanic couples that are teenagers, and after driving across Colorado and drinking tequila and visiting another bar the night before, he wakes up the next morning in Burlington, Colorado. And that's where we're starting. He winced as he opened the curtains again. The bright light caused the back of his eyes to ache. He looked across the street and saw a place with a sign that labeled it Rose's Cafe. It was a white one-story building with picture windows. It looked like they knew how to deep fry stuff, and the parking lot was full. Maybe some breakfast will cure me, he said, stretching. When he walked into Rose's Cafe, he saw a counter running along one side of the room, in front of the kitchen's serving window. High stools were bolted to the floor in front of the counter, padded with pastel blue vinyl. Sam noticed one row of booths against the cafe's windows, and a row of tables in the middle of the room. Against the far wall, a jukebox was playing Harper Valley PTA by Jeannie C. Riley. An older woman with bleach blonde hair, wearing a pale pink waitress dress, stood behind the counter near the door. Her name tag said Rose. Sam wondered if she was the Rose who owned the cafe. She was rolling up silverware and napkins when she glanced up at Sam. Sit anywhere you want, hon, she said with a smile. The cafe was about half filled with customers. Sam saw five middle-aged men sitting at a large table at the far end, dressed in heavy overalls and wearing baseball caps. All sipped coffee from white porcelain cups while throwing cigarettes. The remains of the men's breakfast lay upon their plates. They were all large men, weathered by the prairie, sun, and wind, and they talked and laughed in the easy way of close friends meeting for their 10,000th breakfast at Rose's. "Hey, Robert," one of the men shouted to his buddy. "Where's Billy these days? Is he too good to meet us for breakfast anymore?" "You know Billy and that widow Doris are playing house now," answered Robert. "I hear he's getting some home cooking these days." They all chuckled. After sipping their coffee and blowing smoke into the air, the farmers continued to discuss the weather, the price of seed and fertilizer, and their hopes for their crops they were just now planting in the ground. Sam took one of the booths near the windows. A black-haired waitress who looked to be in her 40s came to his table. Her name tag read Gloria. She flashed a genuine smile and said, "You look like you could use a decent meal, honey. Need some coffee?" "Like life itself," he said. "Thank you. Coming right up. Here's a menu." He opened it after she handed it to him. Although the tequila was still affecting his appetite, he was determined to fuel up for whatever lay ahead. When Gloria returned to the table with his coffee, he ordered three scrambled eggs, bacon, sausage, hash browns, and toast. He ordered the hash browns covered with chopped onions and cheese. "Good boy," said Gloria. He stared out the window at the semis and pickup trucks rolling past the cafe. He listened to the conversations around him, the clattering of dishes in the kitchen, and Jeannie C. Riley lamenting about social inequity on the jukebox. He relaxed and let his mind go where it wanted to go. "Order up," yelled the cook. Gloria brought his food and refilled his coffee cup. Sam sipped his coffee and bit into the bacon. Perfect, he thought. Just crisp enough, but not overcooked. The salty taste complemented the eggs, which were light and fluffy. The hash browns were fried to a crunch on the outside, while still tender on the inside, just the way Sam liked them. His appetite had definitely returned. He wolfed his food down for a few minutes and then settled down to a more civilized pace. When he was done, there was nothing left but a half-eaten hash brown that he could not bring himself to finish. He heard someone slipping into his own booth across the table from him. Surprised, Sam looked up to see an ancient man in a brown cowboy hat facing him. He wore thick-rimmed glasses, which enlarged his eyes. He was skinny and frail, made more apparent by his clothes, which were too large for him. The man's wrinkled face further contorted into a wide grin, showing yellowed teeth. "Can I do anything for you, sir?" asked Sam. "Oh, no, young fellow. I was just over there," he said, nodding across the room, "and saw you by yourself over here. You seem like somebody I'd like to know. I can see you ain't from Burlington. I know everybody in this town. Been here all my life. My name is Andy." Sam put his coffee cup down and held out his hand. They shook. "Glad to meet you. I'm Sam." Andy took off his glasses. He reached over, took one of Sam's napkins, and started cleaning the glasses with it. "Yep, nothing happens here I don't know about," he said. He looked around the room. "Take that sweet-looking young lady over there," he said, motioning his head toward a very large woman sitting at a nearby table. "Alice's no-count husband left her a year ago for the checkout girl at Patterson Grocery. Alice was left with a wet-nosed kid in diapers on her hip. She deserves better than that." Sam sipped his coffee. "So what? You wanted to rescue Alice from her troubles or something?" Andy slapped the table and chuckled. "Do I look like I can rescue anybody? Anyway, Alice took him to the woodshed in the divorce, so maybe she can rescue me." He chuckled and put Sam's napkin in his shirt pocket as he seemed to wistfully think about that possibility. "But enough about me. What are you doing here, Sam?" "I'm heading east. Just needed a bite to eat first." "Sorry to see you go. We could use a young strapping guy like yourself around here. Now, I understand how you might think there's nothing around here for a guy like you, but I like it. It's my home. I struggle sometimes, but wouldn't change a thing. He paused. Maybe I'd like to change to a rich girlfriend. They laughed. Sam found his company easy. You hang out at Roses a lot? Asked Sam. Oh, yeah. You want to meet women in Burlington, you come to Roses. Sam looked around the room at the girlfriend prospects and smiled. He thought about people's differing tastes. Gloria came to the table with the coffee pot. Now, Andy, what have I told you about bothering the customers? Let the poor boy eat his breakfast without having to listen to your nonsense. My darling, I am a customer. In fact, I'll treat you to lunch right in here, right now, he said as he patted the seat next to him, if you'll have me. Why aren't you the big spender? This place is rated 5 stars, I hear. Best cuisine in the West. But I'll bet you'd forget your wallet and make me pay for it. Andy leered at Gloria. She laughed, shook her head, and walked away. Andy reached across the table. You done with those hash browns? Sam walked out of the cafe with more power than he entered with. At least his legs were steady and working right, and he certainly felt better. If Andy could be optimistic about meeting women, maybe Sam could be optimistic about things too.
And that's James Charles Smith reading from Flightless Falcon. I've been in those diners, you know, it's been a few years.
Yeah.
It's been a few years, but yeah, although I will say, like, my daughter was here from, you know, I live in a small town here, and my daughter and her fiance were here a month or so ago, went into a coffee shop, and we're kind of surprised at how everyone tried to chat them up. And of course, everybody knows who I am. And so it didn't take long for them to figure out, oh, she belongs here. That's her mom. And you know, but
yeah.
So it's still that way in some small towns, or probably most right. small towns. But
I think so too.
Yeah. On the other hand, I sometimes like the anonymity of a city. So you can go into a coffee shop or a diner and you can sit there and you can have a conversation with someone, but you don't ever even have to exchange names. And
yeah.
And then you can leave.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Yep.
And yeah. you got somebody like Andy who knows every bit of dirt of everybody on town. You know?
Yep, yep.
So yeah, sometimes a bigger city is better for them.
So you know, Sam is hitchhiking, and there seem to be a lot of people hitchhiking. Most of the ramps that he's on a ramp to the interstate, and there's a number of people there, and they all seem to get rides.
Right.
So were you a big hitchhiker yourself?
Yes, I was. That was my main form of transportation for a long time until I could afford a car.
And nowadays, I don't see hitchhikers on the road very often.
No, they're not around.
Yeah, and I hitchhiked exactly one time, and it was in Spain in the summer of 1976. And it was quite an adventure. And we weren't going very far. And the only reason we hitchhiked, well, there were two reasons. So I was there with a group of students from my high school, and our guidance counselor was supposedly our chaperone. Now, the group I was with, we had just graduated. So we were kind of on our own in a way. We didn't have much chaperoning. The chaperone was there for the kids who were still in high school. But she decided she wanted to go with us. We were trying to get into the city from the college campus we were on. And she's the one who said we should hitchhike when the bus wouldn't stop because it was full. The bus kept going by and we couldn't figure out how we were going to get in. So she said, oh, let's just hitchhike. And so, well, okay, our guidance counselor's telling us to hitchhike. Well, she was like 26 or 20, something like that. She wasn't really a grown-up either.
Yeah.
And but we didn't know really where we were going or how to get there. And we had to split into two cars because there were five of us. No one's going to pick up five hitchhikers. But
right.
It all worked out in the end. We found each other at the other end, and we figured out where we were, and But it was, yeah. But I wouldn't have done that in the U.S. We were also, Spain was just coming out of a, not military rule exactly, but kind of, you know, they had had a dictator and they were under military rule. And so it felt
Franco.
Like things right after Franco. Yeah. So I guess we thought it was safer because of that. I don't know if that was accurate or not. But.
Well, you know, it was just, I think it was safer back in the day that I'm speaking of because of the number of people who did it and the number of people who stopped. So when you think of all those people that were out there, your chances of running across somebody who was a real deviant was probably less. But I think otherwise, I think it's a perception thing more than it is anything else. People heard horror stories about both things, you know, drivers and hitchhikers being attacked.
I have to admit, as I was reading this, I kept kind of waiting for something bad to happen to him with one of these drivers.
Well, that's why Leonard was put in there, was to give you that, because I wanted a little bit of, hey, this is not routine and there is a little danger to it. So I put that whole episode of Leonard in, Leonard being the angry World War II vet who kicks him out of his car.
Yeah.
You know, that was there to get that tension established.
Yeah. Yeah. But of course he was a jerk, but he wasn't a maniac.
Not that we know anyway.
Not that we know. Yeah. 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 It wasn't. And also after a year of training, I got to ask by the time you resigned from the Air Force Academy, were you in the best shape of your life?
Yes. Yeah. Without doubt. I mean, I was not as strong as I lost a lot of weight when I went there. So I was maybe 165 pounds when I went in. I was 145 by the time I was done. And I didn't have any fat on my body in the first place. So I think, again, that was, and I go into the book a little bit about the hazing that occurs at the meals and things like that. And that I think had a lot to do with me sinking to that weight. Now, it only took me about a year to get back to where I was before, but it was hard to, but I was in great, I could run forever like a deer. So, I mean, it was.
Yeah. But that's, you would think that they wouldn't, because people can get sick. People can, if you aren't getting the proper nutrition and you're having that intense physical challenges, that's not healthy.
Well, it's funny you say that, because there was a friend of our family that was on assignment as the head of the hospital at the Air Force Academy when I was out there. And he was actually the one that, there's an episode where he gets sick while he's at a dinner. That was at his house, actually. And he was head of the hospital. So there wasn't going to be any arguing in him about going to the hospital. But he told me that he had a campaign to stop the mealtime hazing, just because of what you're saying. Cadets were developing ulcers. They were, you know, it was, but it, you know, he couldn't, even with his position, he couldn't buck tradition, you know.
Wow. You know, here in Iowa, of course, wrestling is a big sport. Oh, yeah. And high school boys cutting weight for wrestling is, mm-hmm. damages their health for life.
I know. That's true.
And they don't realize it. And I don't know why. I mean, I was a parent in that situation, you know, with a son who was wrestling, and I said he shouldn't cut weight, and they did it behind my back, you know?
Yeah.
And, the coach knew, his father knew, but I didn't know that he was doing it.
Yeah, my son was a wrestler too for a while. The stuff that he went through to do, the only wrestling I did was in junior high school, there was a school championship, and I was huge for my age, so I was like in the heavyweight division.
My son's father was a very good wrestler, but he developed the habit of chewing tobacco that he, I don't know if he ever was able to quit it completely in order to cut weight. So,
oh, is that right? So he did it for a weight thing. Oh my gosh. Okay.
Yeah. He did it to cut weight. Also, student athletes back then, we're talking in the 70s, mm-hmm. early 70s, a lot of drugs, speed.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, things like that. And I think probably everybody knew it. And as long as they were performing,
they
looked the other way.
Right.
Yeah. So it's like, in a way, that's what this book is about too, that we expect things of these kids, really, that aren't good for them or harmful to them. But as long as the people in power are getting what they want out of it, everybody looks the other way.
I think that's true. But yeah. we are moving incrementally ahead. I think we are.
That is true. That is true.
Think of all the things we're talking about now that aren't done anymore because we figured out they were stupid, you know.
Yeah, for
wrestling,
sure.
For weight, I don't know about that one, but
yeah, I don't know either.
I think the reason why they did it and was that it was in their own best interest not to wrestle somebody who was bigger than them. You know,
to have weight classes. Have to have weight classes. But what they should have done is had rules that essentially you weigh in 6 months in advance of the season or something like that, and then you weigh in again at the end. Because what they would do, what these boys would do, is they'd beef up for football.
Right.
And then they would drastically cut weight for wrestling to get into the lowest weight class they possibly could. And you don't have to. And then even after the weigh-ins, you were allowed to like gain 5 pounds or something after the weigh-in. Mm-hmm. So they'd starve themselves for the weigh-in and then gorge and it was this pattern of over and over and over again. So they shouldn't be allowed to like lose 20 pounds in the 2 months before wrestling starts, basically. Yeah.
When they should have, you know, if they're overweight and you know, that's one thing, but I mean that, yeah, you're taking kids who are in pretty darn good shape to begin with. And then, you know, really.
Right. Right. Yeah. Okay. So you started writing this book. It took you a while. At what point did you feel it was ready to send out? How did you know?
That's a good question. Well, I went through 8 revisions, I think, before I sent it to the publisher. And I, to tell you the truth, in my own mind, it was ready. But there were a lot of changes and improvements to it that happened after that point, you know, from the publishers, editors, and things like that. So I thought it was, the history of the book, my favorite author, I guess, of all time is Hemingway. Not so much as a person, but as a writer, because he is just so economical with his wording. He can say more in a sentence than Faulkner can say in 4 pages, you know, and I always admired that. So the first versions of my book were kind of cryptic, and I was counting on the reader to read a lot into it and things like that. And it wasn't right, you know, I thought, but at the time, so a writer fools himself into thinking that it's ready when it's not ready. So, you know, it was that.
Yeah. Yeah. I have that same tendency to want to write very sparely and sometimes get feedback that it's just not enough, you know, that the reader needs more. But Hemingway figured out how to do it, didn't he?
Yes, absolutely.
So you had eight revisions. You had thought you had something that you thought was completely done. You started sending it out. How did you decide where to send it, and how did that road to publication go for you?
Well, it was difficult for sure. I started out in the traditional way, sending queries out to agents and trying to do the traditional publishing model where, you know, you get paid an advance and you know, they buy publishing rights and you get royalties. And I tried that, sent out close to 400 query letters. And that was after researching in reference materials what agent was interested in. Out of that, I got, I think, three rejection letters, and the rest was crickets, you know. And so I just happened, through a friend of a friend, discover Brown Books, which is publishing my book. I get it's okay to say to mention them. And they are more of a hybrid model. So the author themselves pays a little more for their services. But I was really very impressed with their creative services, their editing. They're doing a lot about publicity and arranged to have this interview for one thing, for instance. So, I was totally ignorant on how to publish a book. So I took the choice to try to get experts to help me with it.
So how much input did you have in the cover design on your book?
I gave them some suggestions, and they gave me like three cover designs back. So I give them total credit for that cover. I think it's a great looking cover myself. I can brag on it. But
so describe the cover a little bit.
Okay, so basically it is what Sam is looking at as he's hitchhiking. He's looking back towards the mountains, and you have the road trailing off up into the distance. There's a couple of references to other things, and there's a jet contrail in the background, so that signifies his loss of not he really wanted to be a pilot for sure, and so that was something that he had to live with when he resigned, was that he was giving up that chance. So that contrail and the title Flightless Falcon all refer to that he gave up part of a dream to attain the larger dream in his mind.
Did you want to be a pilot?
Oh yes, I did. I really did.
And did you ever go back and try for that?
No, I didn't. I never had the money to take. You know, that's a pretty expensive hobby for sure.
Yeah. So that's the meaning of the title, Flightless Falcon. And why Falcon?
Falcon is the mascot for the Air Force Academy.
Okay. And is there a plane that's nicknamed the Falcon too, or is that?
No.
Okay.
I say that, but there may be one, but I didn't think of that. I think there's probably a later plane that's a more modern plane that's called a Falcon, but I'm not sure.
I feel like there is, but I could be wrong about that.
I mean, they should have if they didn't.
Yeah,
they
really.
Used every other bird.
it's a great name. So do you still like to fly in an airplane?
I used to. It's become such a pain to fly anymore. Mainly because you have to be at the airport 2 hours before you leave, and
I just flew back from Dallas to Cedar Rapids 2 days ago, and I had to board the plane three times for one flight.
Oh my gosh!
We got on, we got off, we got on, we got off. Finally made it home like six hours late.
Yeah, well, I had a similar experience going to Houston and from Atlanta, and turns out that after delays and everything else, I could have gotten there driving like 2 hours earlier.
I know it's and now with the weather, all the weather issues, it's just getting worse and worse. I did want to ask you about one thing, which is that, you know, the book does go into, it's kind of the divide in the country because of the Vietnam War and the controversy and the conflict. Do you see similarities with what's going on today?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, yeah. For sure. There may not be one issue like the Vietnam War, but I, you know, the division within the country is just as bad or worse. But I wanted also to give people the understanding that our political system has been in disarray and a mess before, and we survived. So we should not feel, you know, that we should keep hope. And meanwhile, you know, I was asked at one interview once, you know, what I wanted the reader to take away. And to me, what I wanted them to take away was that the importance of respect for each other and to have empathy and not to just assume that everyone is evil. That is the thing that I think is the hardest to experience is not only do now, instead of saying, well, your policies are wrong, you know, we're saying, no, you're evil. And that's just not the way to go. So we've got to learn to be more respectful somehow.
You have a teacher in here at a farm. One of the characters who is is kind of
Jerry.
Giving that message, right?
Right. Yes.
Yeah. Do you want to tell us a little bit about Jerry and?
Jerry is kind of loosely based on someone I met later in life that was kind of, you know, a leader of, it wasn't really a commune, but it was, he was, anyway, he was that's the person that it was kind of named after. But that speech that he gave was totally out of my head. I didn't, I wasn't copying something that somebody else said.
So, you know, he says, we naturally fear what we don't understand and hate what we fear. And then he goes on to saying, you don't have to hate everyone just because one is bad or one is causing a problem. You just need to understand their natures and experiences and why they're doing that. And I think that's a really important message that that people should pay attention to now too.
Thank you.
Do you see similarities?
And the other thing too, I might add too, is when you're hitchhiking, you are put in a very receptive position of, you know, you're not going to get into somebody's car and be argumentative with them, you know, unless
right.
you're forced into it. So you are naturally respectful and you're open to those people to try to do more, nothing more than start a conversation, you know? And so that was the other kind of mechanism for showing that kind of understanding that we need to have.
Yes. Now, do you see similarities on what's happening on college campuses today regarding the Gaza war with the Vietnam, the protests over the Vietnam
yeah,
war?
It's pretty similar. That did kind of set me back. For sure, when they were doing that.
Yeah, because you wrote this book before any of that started happening, for sure.
I know.
Yeah.
I know.
And I feel like some of the people who are so against those protests now, were they the same people who were protesting back then?
Exactly. Isn't that funny? I know. You look at these people who were former hippies and they're you know, they're right wing wing nuts now, and you just wonder
Although they may be the age of hippies, but it may not be that they, because the hippie movement and the student groups for nonviolent democratic society, and that was not a majority of that age group. We think of it that it was, but it wasn't. And so maybe the ones who are in power now and who are controlling things are not the ones who were, you know, anti-establishment back then.
Yeah. And, you know, I do think that there were, even though there weren't that many of them that were very hardcore, I do believe that one of the unique things about 1968, 69 and those years was the number of people from all sides that were sharing at least some of the viewpoints of that movement, whether it be peace or whether it be racial relations, and at the time, I think the focus was a little more nonviolent than it may be now. That's something I find to be kind of alarming. But you of course did have some of those people being violent, as I say in the book. When I'm going and looking at some of the headlines that are happening at the time, you know, there's open conflict with rocks and guns and everything else going on, even when it was remembered to be a nonviolent time, you know, or not,
right.
I won't say nonviolent time, but a nonviolent attitude by the opposition.
Right. Yeah. But you're right. There was some of that going on, and there probably is some, I'm sure that there are leaders of what we might call the resistance now who are focused on nonviolence as well as they were back then. And it's hard to we've come a long way. Like you said, you do in the book, you get into kind of not very deeply, but you at least bring up the subject of race and discrimination.
Right.
And, you know, one of your characters talks about, boy, if you're a black hippie, you're really going to go through it because you're going to get discriminated against for being black and for being a hippie. At least as a hippie, I can cut my hair and show up as a conservative white guy and not get any flack
exactly.
If I choose. But if you're black, what do you do? So
yeah, you're stuck.
Yeah. And so I do think that
we
have made a lot of progress.
I was afraid to travel in the South in 1968 and 69.
Really?
You know, I really was. Yes. There were situations like I refer to in the book where the guys, the hippie guys, basically are getting yelled at by passing drivers, and they swerve over and almost hit them. And it seemed like there was a lot more of that in the South than there was North. But, you know, I could be wrong, too.
Yeah. No, I think you're probably right. You're probably right. So we have made a lot of progress, both, you know, women's rights, racial justice. But in some ways, it's like, why are we still having to fight these battles all over again in some cases?
Yes. And it seems like the arguments are getting more and more illogical. You know, I listen to what some of our leaders say on TV, and I'm going, that makes no sense whatsoever. But it's appealing to a lot of people just because of the emotional content of it, you know.
So you live in the South now.
Yes.
and I'm guessing that your viewpoints aren't necessarily the same as a lot of your neighbors.
That's true, especially in North Georgia. Now, Atlanta is as progressive as any city in America. But the surrounding area is, it's pretty thin veneer of civilization sometimes.
Yeah, that's true in Texas, too. Austin, Dallas, and Houston,
tell me about it.
San Antonio are all very progressive cities in their way, you know. Mm-hmm. I think Houston was the first major city to have an openly lesbian mayor, and Dallas had a female sheriff. And, you know, there's a lot of, and of course, Austin, we all know, is very progressive. And yet, most of the state is the representatives and stuff are right wing. So
that's right. Yeah. Georgia's the same way. I mean, they really are.
It's almost become more of a city versus country divide. Or do you think that was the case in the 60s too?
Oh, there was definitely a bit of that for sure. I mean, there's always been the country people grumbled about the big city people and being how they were rude and how they were, you know, so there was always a little bit of a cultural divide between country but I don't think it was as barbed as it is now, you know.
Yeah.
It was more like an observation, boy, you're strange because you're from the city. But there wasn't the hate attached to it so much.
Yeah. Well, James, what's your next book? What are you working on now?
I've got two ideas. One of them is kind of a semi-sequel, but Sam's not in it anymore. But it would be a jump ahead to the next year when all of the trouble over Kent State. And I mean, 1970 was also a very flammable year. And there's lots to be said about that. And then, you know, if this doesn't seem to be the, you know, if this doesn't catch on for some reason, I'll knock on wood that it does. You know, I even talked about doing a mystery, murder mystery. So I haven't made up my mind yet. I'm kind of waiting to see which way this goes, because obviously if it became a very popular book, then the readers would want to know more, you know.
Right.
If they ignore it, maybe it's time to try something else, you know.
So what's the publication date for Flightless Falcon?
Oh, it was 21st of May.
21st of May, 2024.
So it's been out. It's been out about a little more than a week here.
And have you gotten any feedback?
Oh, yes. It's currently on Amazon. It's 5-star rated.
Awesome.
Not that many rated.
But the ones who rated love it. Okay, very good.
But it's funny. I don't know if there's a place where you can go and figure out what the sales are. I haven't discovered what that is yet. I probably wouldn't want to go there anyway. It would just be something I would spend the time going, well, now what it's doing, you know. What?
Well, James Charles Smith, welcome to the world of published authors with Flightless Falcon. And we're out of time. We always end with the quote. So I picked one from Leo Tolstoy's War and Peace. If everyone fought for their own convictions, there would be no war.
That's great. That's a good quote.
Yeah.
Well, I certainly appreciate the invitation, and it was very nice talking to you.
It was our pleasure, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
That sounds good. Thank you.